Greetings and solicitations. It's Thursday. It is time to once again go into the world of Epiphany, the book that I am still writing. It's still in progress. We do have a couple of things ready to deal with that. We're going to be doing chapter 15 and chapter 16 as time will allow, because chapter 15 is somewhat short, and I feel like it got to catch up a little bit. So before we start, this past week we had a little bit of bad news. The proprietor of a place that I used to work, is called the Cross Keys Tavern, had passed away on, I think it was Monday. It's either Monday or Tuesday. The days are all going together. And anyway, he was a very kind man. Name of Tom Burke. I enjoyed talking to him the few times that I've seen him since moving down here to Texas. And I actually worked for him just after my 21st, or the summer after my 21st birthday. I learned a lot about things with Tom, about life, of life in general, and the bar business. Something that, one of these days I might just go play bartender again somewhere just for the hell of it. Tom, I really do appreciate the hospitality you've had. Incidentally, the Cross Keys Tavern is a minor character, or is actually a location for a couple of scenes in my first book, Finding Glenn Mike, or no, not Finding Glenn Michaels. It was Saving Magnolia. Finding Glenn Michaels was actually one of the working titles on it. So, without too much ado, here comes Epiphany. Chapter 15. Your husband's in jail were the four words that Emily Stevens never expected to hear. She stood open-mouthed while a voice on the other end of the line brought her up to speed with the situation. He was just hauled off by the sheriff earlier this afternoon, Beasley continued. I've talked with him. Agent Hamner's talked with him, and neither one of us thinks he's done a thing. Well, I got a call from the local agent here saying that Dan was already in custody, Emily pointed out. What's this about him being hauled off by the sheriff? Agent Hamner took responsibility for your husband earlier today, Beasley explained. Local sheriff here hates Hamner because he's black. The sheriff got a judge to issue a search and an arrest warrant based on a tip that there might be an incendiary devices in your husband's car. They were just here. They found what they were looking for, and the sheriff had your husband sent to the county seat. They found what? Emily was confused. They found devices which could be used to start fires. I had a short conversation with Agent Hamner before I called you. He's certain that your husband has nothing to do with either arson. The devices were most likely planted. Who would do such a thing? Emily mumbled. I have no idea. I will tell you this, though. I know a lawyer here local who can stall just long enough for us to get your husband out of the sheriff's hands so we can find out who's really responsible. We need your help, though. Do you need me to come over? Emily asked. No, Beasley said flat out. If you were to show up here, the sheriff will have you thrown in jail for being an accomplice. What I need from you are some sizes so I can outfit your husband for some backcountry camping. For what? We're going to head for the hills, so to speak. Make him disappear for a while. Will he be safe? Emily asked. Yes. My only concern at the moment is whether or not you feel comfortable knowing your husband is alone in the company of another woman. Beasley's stated concern caught Emily by surprise. By his admission, Dan had never been alone with another woman in what could end up being in a compromising situation. She had to admit to herself that of course she didn't feel uncomfortable. At the same time, though, she had the feeling that there was a sense of urgency in the request. How well do I really know the man I married? She asked herself. Well enough to have had four children with him. Her answer became immediately. Miss Beasley, I'm not quite certain, Emily almost told the FBI agent. He has earned your trust just as surely as you earned his. Emily recalled the first time she ever laid eyes on Dan Stevens. He was the stranger at the front door of her parents' house, the new assistant pastor her father wanted her to meet. She had just broken up, again, with Charlie Dill and was not particularly interested in spending an evening bored to tears while watching this new man squirm while her father gave him the third degree. She told this stranger she wasn't interested at almost the instant she opened the door. In the second or two between saying what she felt she had to say and slamming the door in the assistant pastor's face, she saw her children. Emily Griswold slumped down with her back to the door. She had suddenly been confronted with her future. When the time comes, when the right person comes along, the fact will hit you like a lightning bolt. She recalled what her father told her less than 4 weeks earlier. She started panting, panicked. Ken Griswold came up to his daughter. She could tell by his smile that he knew what had just happened. She didn't remember exactly what he said, but she did manage to recover her composure long enough to apologize to the man who would soon be her husband. During dinner, Emily could have sworn that she was catching glimpses into the soul of Daniel Stevens. After dinner, they walked and talked late into the night. The next morning, she presented herself to the man she met just hours before. There'd be no turning back for either of them. "Yes, I trust him, Miss Beasley. If I were in a similar situation, he would trust me as well." "I figured that," Beasley laughed. "By the way, it's just Beasley. It's what my friends call me." Beasley spent a few minutes getting some details from Emily before giving her a contact phone number and running over what would probably happen in the next several days. "By the way, your husband gave us a description of someone of interest. I'll fax over a copy to Agent Barada to show you. Maybe you've seen him. The Bureau would appreciate any help you can give us." Emily's apprehensions didn't end when she hung up the phone. She wasn't quite sure about Dan being out of touch in a place she didn't know in the company of a government agent. There were stories out there about sinister government plots to silence people who knew too much. Perhaps there was something Dan knew which threatened national security. Then again, he told her everything. He held back nothing. Neither did she. After thinking about it for a while, she came to the conclusion that she needed to trust Dan and trust Beasley. Dan would not betray her. Just before bedtime, there was a knock on the parsonage door. Emily hurried from the kitchen to find Gracie talking through the screen to a screen door to a man outside. "Gracie, you need to get ready to go to bed," she told her child. Gracie turned and went upstairs with Frank the dog following closely behind. Emily turned her attention to the caller. "Emily Griswold," the man stated. "Your daughter is charming. May I come in?" It was Eric Cavallo. She stood, not knowing what to say or to do. "I'm working with Bob Barada on your husband's case, Mrs. Stevens," Eric assured her, showing his badge. "It's a little late, at least 15 years for a social call." She went ahead and let him in, ushering him into the kitchen. She glanced upstairs to see all of her children and Frank watching to see what would happen next. "Let me cut to the chase," he said, once they were both seated. He pulled the drawing out of his top pocket and set it in front of her. "Have you ever seen this man?" She studied the picture. There was something disturbingly familiar about the face which she couldn't quite put a finger on. "Is this a drawing Miss Beasley told me about?" Emily asked. Agent Cavallo nodded. "She's the best that I know of," he stated. "Your husband has already told us that this drawing is remarkably similar to someone he's seen in West Virginia these past couple of days." She looked at the picture again. Again, she was sure she'd seen the face, but couldn't quite place it. "I think I've seen this man, but I'm not certain when or where," she stammered. "Well, there's a start. We think that the man may have a local connection. We don't know what it is yet, but we would appreciate it if you'd give us a call if you can think of who it might be." He left the picture, got up, and excused himself. She got up and walked him to the door. "So you up and married a marauder, huh?" Eric chuckled when they got to the door. "Well, how about you? What have you done for yourself?" Emily asked. "Married, divorced, two girls living with their mother up in Gahanna. I move around. I'm renting a room in Prentice for the duration. They chatted for a few minutes, exchanging a few details of each other's lives before Eric called it an evening and left. While she started to secure the door, she heard a steady thump, 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 thump from the top of the stairs. She turned to see her three children and Frank the dog watching her. She turned back to her task, stifling a laugh at the intense audience which she was or what she had while saying goodnight to a former boyfriend. Chapter 16. Rusty drove the cruiser back to the county seat fast enough to be safe, but too fast for Dan to be comfortable. The car tires squealed coming around blind corners. Dan thought about saying something about increasing the tire pressure on the tired older Crown Victoria, but figured that the enthusiastic deputy might take his comments out of context. Let them know that you're afraid, and they'll most likely take more risks, Dan thought after flying through yet another blind corner at a twice the suggested limit. They finally arrived at Parsons at a newer brick building housing a jail and the sheriff's office. Dan was led into a reception area where he was relieved of his personal items, booked and fingerprinted, all while being watched by an elderly gentleman with a ring of white hair around a bald spot on top of his head. When the ordeal was over and his mugshot was taken, the older gentleman got up from his seat and approached. "You're Pastor Stevens, I take it," the man stated, extending his hand. "I'm Bubba, Bubba Wolf. My proper first name is Harlan. Beasley called and told me to come meet you. If you let me, I'll be a lawyer." Before Dan could respond, Rusty started to herd him toward the holding cells. "Now look here, Rusty," the old lawyer protested. "This man has a right to an attorney. You let us be for a few minutes in the conference room." Dan pulled away from the deputy. Rusty responded by pinning the pastor's arm behind his back. "You're coming with me," the deputy growled. "You try anything again, and I'll add resisting arrest to the charges against you." "And I'll have you arrested for taking away this man's rights," Bubba exclaimed. "Now you let that man go and leave him to me." Rusty relented. He released Dan and pointed him toward a small room just off the hallway. Dan joined the lawyer, went into the room with a pair of metal chairs and a heavy wooden table. "Now you sit over here with your back to the window," Bubba instructed the pastor. "That way they can't read your lips. Deputy Lawson at the front desk is partially deaf and he knows how." Dan sat down in the chair as Bubba instructed. "Now, Beasley told me that you might need my help," the lawyer began. "She's already filled me in on some of the details. What I need to know is why the sheriff's men found fire starters in the trunk of your car." "I suppose I do need help," Dan told him. "As far as the devices found in the trunk of my car, I have no earthly idea how they got there. The car belongs to my wife anyway, and I think I might have noticed if there was something in the trunk other than the suitcases I brought from the trip." "Beasley told me that the devices were under the trunk in the spare tire well." "Well, that would explain why I didn't see them," Dan said. His mind started racing. He wondered if maybe Emily had something to do with a fire in Magnolia. He quickly discarded the notion. "Well, I'm going to take your word that you knew nothing about the extra baggage in your trunk," Bubba Wolf declared. "Beasley told me you might have seen someone suspicious earlier today." Dan was amazed that Bubba had changed the subject so quickly. "Was it someone you've seen before?" "Forgot that at the moment." The lawyer changed course yet again. "We need to get you out of here before the sheriff..." Bubba cut his musing short. Dan heard the click of the door behind him. "Well, hello, Bubba," Dan recognized the sheriff's voice. "I ain't had the chance to talk to my prisoner yet, and here you are prepping him so he can get off scot-free. We know he done it. We got the evidence. So you'll run along now, you hear?" Bubba stood up. Dan turned to watch him as he stood toe-to-toe with the sheriff. Now, Bubba was a good 3 inches shorter than the lawman, but it became apparent that Bubba was on the offensive. "All you have are some anonymous tips, circumstance, and not too much time watching cop and lawyer shows," Bubba scolded the lawman. "You know damn good and well that the recent church arsons are under investigation as a federal crime. You're out of your jurisdiction, George, and you know that, too." Sheriff George Pinkerman was getting red in the face. "It's because of Agent Hamner, isn't it, George?" Well, that ignorant nigger didn't know nothing, the sheriff growled. We got his arsonist for him, and by God, I'm going to see how I get the credit, not him. Sheriff Pinkerman tried to reach around Bubba in order to drag Dan out of the conference room. Bubba blocked him. You'll do no such thing, Bubba told the sheriff. Agent James Hamner is on his way here right now, and if you use the N-word one more time, at least in my presence, I'll see that you'll need a plumber to help you swallow your lunch. The sheriff stepped back. Dan surmised that Bubba and the sheriff had tangled on more than one occasion. Your boy better be here inside of 15 minutes, Sheriff Pinkerman spat on the floor at Bubba's feet. Otherwise, I'm personally taking your client to the cell block. The sheriff stormed back out, slamming the conference room door behind him. Well, from the sounds of it, he has a giant-sized chip on his shoulder, Dan remarked. More like a forest, Bubba chuckled. All the more reason to get you out of here and out of sight as soon as possible. Would Agent Hamner be coming? Dan asked. I sure as hell hope so. I told Beasley to send him here. Hopefully she'll be able to get a hold of him. I don't think it'll be a problem. I've known Hamner for a while. Good man. I've been trying to convince him to settle here in Tucker County and run for sheriff instead of that asshole. Now, wouldn't the folk here have something to say about it? Dan asked. I mean, how long has Sheriff Pinkerman been in office? Well, he's been in office for the better part of a dozen years, Bubba informed him. No one's run against him in the past couple of elections. I should say that no one has the guts to run against him in the past couple of elections. I take it he gets all the votes then. Well, hardly anyone voted for him, rightfully saying. He only got 277 votes last election out of over 1,500 cast. Now, don't get me wrong, he's not a dirty cop. In fact, he's a really good cop. But he has a propensity for pissing off the wrong people at the wrong time. Like dropping the N-bomb, right? Bubba smiled. There's still lots of folks here who think it's okay to call a man the N-word. James let it roll off his back. It tells me he thinks it's okay, but I know deep down it hurts him. We're all equal in the sight of the Lord, Dan said quietly. Glad you said that, Bubba replied. Now I know for sure I can trust you. Now before James gets here, tell me why you're in Tucker County and tell me what you can about this mystery man you think you saw. Dan told the lawyer about his trip from Magnolia, including why he made it. He established that he was a guest and that he knew nothing about the items found in his trunk. I do recall, at least I think I recall, something coming up or going down the drive to the cabin on Sunday at night, Dan pointed out. It might mean something or it might mean nothing. I have no idea. You have an idea whether it was a man or a woman you heard? I couldn't tell you, Dan said after pondering for a moment or two. Maybe we'll have to go back up to your cabin and have a look, Bubba said. Maybe the best thing for me to do is go up to the cabin, gather whatever hasn't been rifled through, and go home, Dan sighed. Well, the sheriff would be on you in a New York minute. If I wasn't involved, he'd find a way to have you shot while trying to escape. He wouldn't do that, would he? Don't bet that he wouldn't. Bubba paced back and forth in the conference room while Dan watched him, wondering what would happen next. Snippets of polite conversation passed back and forth between the men for a little over an hour. Dan and Bubba discovered that they both had a love for fast cars and raising hell in their youth. My daddy got tired of bailing me out of trouble all the time, Bubba confessed. Told me that I should become a lawyer. And that was before I learned that a lawyer defending himself has a fool for a client. I wonder if the same rule applies to pastors, Dan postulated. I feel as if maybe being a pastor is driving me away from God. You're busy with your flock, I take it, Bubba winked. You take on too much and you're sure you'd burn out sooner or later. Bubba paused. Poor choice of words, son. I apologize. It's okay, Dan assured the lawyer. Pastors are known to have a high burnout rate, and some of them don't take drastic measures when they're under pressure. Or some of them do take drastic measures while they're under pressure. Years ago, we had a preacher go berserk. He killed his wife and his kids, set fire to his church, and committed suicide right in front of my best friend. Ouch! Bubba winced. Sounds like that preacher was a bubble of two off plum. Well, that was an extreme case. I don't think I'm that far along yet, but I feel as if I may be headed in that direction. Sheriff Pinkerman dropped by for the fifth time since Dan and Bubba went into the conference room. Each time he declared that his patience was wearing thin, that he wanted to put Dan in a holding cell. Each time the sheriff made his wishes known, Bubba insisted that he needed more time to debrief his client. This time he came in armed with a shotgun. He was not going to be denied. "You've had enough talk, preacher. You're coming with me," Sheriff Pinkerman insisted. "Help's on the way," Bubba confided. "In the meantime, let the sheriff have his way." Dan reluctantly followed the sheriff out of the room. He was led down a narrow corridor to a steel door guarded by someone who was clearly bored by his job guarding the steel door. The man got up and handed Dan a parcel. "Strip, then put these on," the sheriff insisted. Inside the parcel was an orange jumpsuit and a pair of slippers for his feet. "No underwear?" Dan asked. "You ain't going to be wearing any, preacher. Now hurry up. I ain't got time for your nonsense." Dan reluctantly peeled out of what he was wearing, aware that every move he made was being carefully watched by a pair of men who obviously felt he was guilty of whatever it was they might be accused of doing. He felt shame at being naked, alone, and vulnerable. He quickly put on the jumpsuit after being carefully inspected by the men guarding him. Trust was absent in this place. He was alone. Emily, Jacob, Peter, Grace, and Hope were fading from his memory. He was about to take his first step into the belly of the beast, where even God was reluctant to tread. That does it here for the two chapters. We'll be doing chapter 17 next week. I should have warned people about use of the N-word. I think it was appropriate in the context in which we used it. I will apologize if that offended you. Nothing else really to say. We're going to get this in by 12 noon Central Time. And in the meantime, hey, we appreciate talking with you. Have a gooder. Bye-bye.